What is an antidote when your mind is going nuts, you know, visualizing the object of your sexual attachment? Okay. One great antidote is to think of the insides of that person's body. Okay. This antidote, if you do it, it works. If you don't do it, then you just blame and say, I don't like it, I don't like it. But if you do it, it works, let me tell you. Okay? So you sit there and you think of the person that you're sexually attracted to and you peel away their skin. Okay? You peel away their, mentally, I mean, don't go out and do it. Okay? Mentally, you peel away their skin and you look at what's under their skin. Yeah? All those muscles, you know, that face that is so beautiful, you peel away the skin, you know, and there's muscles. And under the muscles, there's bones and skeleton. Yeah? And then you open up their insides, you know, and there's more muscles and skeleton and liver and kidneys and intestines. You think of what's inside their intestines and what's inside their stomach. And, you know, you think of their mouth with just the teeth and the tongue in it. And, you know, you do this visualization. Your sexual desire goes down real quick, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay? So if you're trying to meditate and you're having a problem with a lot of lust, this is a very good meditation to do. Okay. It's also good meditation to do on your own body when you feel yourself, you know, just having a lot of attachment and concern and worry about your own body, you know, and just, oh, my body's sick, my body's uncomfortable. Then you kind of mentally dissect your own body and you see what it is and you go, you know, it's just a bunch of atoms and molecules, nothing there really to be attached to. So we're not... This, don't mix this up with Christianity, you know, that, you know, sex is evil and sinful and dirty, you know, but save it for the person you love the most. yeah. Don't get into that thing, okay? We're not saying sex is evil and dirty. We're just trying to look at what our bodies are. Okay? You know? And this is what our bodies are. They're made of atoms and molecules. And they're filled with a lot of stuff that actually isn't so attractive. Don't you agree? Yeah? In Thai Buddhism, the monks often go to, I don't know, a few times a year, they go to autopsies. And so last year, one of my teachers asked me to learn more about Theravada Buddhism. So I went and spent some time in Thailand, and I asked the master of the temple I was staying at if he could arrange for us to go to an autopsy. And he did, and it was fascinating. It's so interesting. And, you know, you just kind of walk into this room, and there's this guy lying naked, you know. And you kind of, he had only been dead a few hours, so you're kind of expecting him to get up off the table and say, oops, excuse me, and put on his pants, you know. But he didn't. And then, you know, they just did the whole autopsy, and it was fascinating, you know, cutting the skull here and peeling it back. And then they had this little kind of, blade, you know, that was round, that spun, and they, you know, cut around here and then took the cranium off and then reached down in and went plop and pulled his brain out and put it in the scale, you know. They, you know how, you know, when you go to the market to buy something, there's a scale. So they plopped his brain in the scale. They weigh it and, you know, mark it down and, you know, and then afterwards they cut from here all the way down and opened him up, and, you know, then they had to cut the sternum to be able to open up the rib cage, and then they, you know, reached in again and pulled out the lungs and the tongue and the heart, and, you know, the whole thing came out. It was really very fascinating. You know, believe me, you do not get sexually turned on watching this. I mean, it really works, okay? So, and I found it actually very helpful for my meditation, just even recognizing the nature of my own body, because it made me think, you know, well, why are we trying to attain liberation and enlightenment? Well, because, you know, we realize that having bodies like this that are made of atoms and molecules, you know, that get old and sick and die, that this is not an optimum situation for happiness. Okay? I mean, it's true, isn't it? The very nature of our body is not going to bring us pleasure forever and ever. Yeah? I mean, we're very attached to our bodies. We're always trying to think of how to get the most pleasure. You know, even the pleasure of a hot shower. Yeah? We're very attached to the pleasure of a bed that's the right softness, the pleasure of the room that's the right temperature. Why is it so cold here? You know, or why is it too hot? And, you know, and this body's never satisfied. And then the body also gets old and sick and dies. And so it makes us ask ourselves, well, why do I have this body to start with? Well, I have this body because my ignorance and craving wanted it. You know how they say, be careful what you want, be careful what you want because you might get it? Well, this is, you know, Buddhism really brings up this whole issue. Well, why do I have this body? Well, because I wanted it. But now I have it, you know, it's going to get old and sick and die. And okay, it brings me some pleasure, but in the long run, yeah, it's not. So that leads us to generate the aspiration for liberation and full enlightenment, where we can have a body made of light instead of this thing, okay? To have it where we have a mind that isn't so attached to the physical comfort of our body, okay? And we realize that the more we let go of attachment to our body, you know, the more peaceful we are, even if we still have it, even when we still have a body, okay? And the more we're able to let go of you know, this oppressive lust, the more comfortable our mind is, okay? We're not distracted all the time, okay? So Shantideva, because he was speaking to a group of monks who were trying to keep celibate, yeah? So, and because he assumed that everybody was straight, he talked about the insides of a woman's body and what they look like, okay? It wasn't prejudice against women. It was because he was talking to men, assuming they were all straight. If he was talking to a group of men who he assumed were all gay, he would talk about the, you know, ugliness of the male body. If he were talking to a group of straight women, he would have talked about the ugliness of the male body. If he were talking to a group of gay women, he would talk about the ugliness of the female body. Okay? So it has nothing, those passages have nothing to do with gender discrimination. They just have to do with the audience that he's addressing. Because throughout Buddhist history, there's been more monks than nuns. Okay? Although now, interestingly, in Taiwan, there's many more nuns than monks. Yeah, it's quite interesting that kind of social change that happened in Taiwan. Okay, now let's look at the issue of ordination, because that may have come up. So, within Buddhism, there's various levels of ordination. Yeah, you start out with five precepts. Those are the five lay precepts that, you know, you guys could take, anybody could take, to abandon killing, stealing, unwise sexual conduct, lying, and taking intoxicants. Okay, so you start out with that. Then there's the eight precepts, which you can take for one day. And those, when you add on to them, then instead of avoiding unwise sexual behavior, for one day you keep celibacy. And then you also eat one meal a day. You don't wear perfumes, ornaments, garlands, or play music or watch entertainment, and you avoid sitting on high and luxurious seats and, you know, places. And so those are the eight precepts. Then there's a novice ordination with 10 precepts. The Tibetans break the 10 into 36, but they're actually just 10. Okay? And so all of these are available to men and women alike. Okay? Then there is full ordination as a bhikshu or a bhikshuni. Okay? And that's available for men and women alike. In between the novice, but for women, in between the novice and the bhikshuni ordination, there's another ordination called shikshamana, which means a training nun. And this is taken for 2 years so that women can train in the bhikshuni vows before they've actually taken them. Okay? And so you take these ordinations in secret sequence, you know, 5 and 8 and 10. And then if you're a woman, you know, you do this training period, and then you take the full ordination. There's a different number of precepts. For the novices, the number of precepts for men and women are equal. Okay? And for the lay people, the number of precepts are equal. For the monks and nuns, the fully ordained monks and nuns, the number of precepts are not the same. Okay, in the Tibetan system, there are 253 for men and 364 for women. Now, why did this happen? Okay, to understand this, you have to understand the origin of the precepts, the monastic precepts. When the Buddha lived, okay, when he first gave ordination, he just said, "Come, O bhikkhu," you know, and bhikkhu was a mendicant monk. You know, come, O bhikkhu. That was the ordination ceremony. And for the first 12 years, there were no precepts set down for the Sangha to follow because everybody behaved themselves. Yeah. The Buddha started setting, you know, establishing precepts because there were some naughty Sangha members who started doing some things that just weren't appropriate and that were disturbing the minds of other people, that were disturbing harmony in the community, that were making the lay people upset. So whenever the Buddha heard about one of these incidents in which somebody was acting inappropriately, then he said, okay, from now on, you know, my Sangha members should not do X, Y, and Z. And so every single one of our precepts has a story behind it. It is fascinating to read these stories in the Vinaya. The Vinaya is the monastic code, and it's so interesting. If you think our world is corrupt now, you should read what the Buddha's disciples did. You know, the Tibetans say that there were a group of 6 naughty monks. I don't know if all the traditions believe this, you know, because I assume there were probably more, but some of them did some pretty weird things, okay? And so, you know, the vows got, the precepts got established because of these things that got done. Now, what happened is the women, when the Buddha first taught, you know, there were the men coming and ordaining, you know, because the women in ancient India were really, you know, quite oppressed. I'll speak about that a little bit more in a moment. But anyway, the women, when the order of nuns was started 6 years after the order of monks. And, it was, I'll tell you that story too in a minute. But anyway, my point here is, that when the order of women was begun, the order of nuns, then we got all the precepts that came from the mistakes the monks made, plus some additional precepts due to the mistakes the nuns made. But the monks just had the precepts from their own mistakes. They didn't get the ones from the mistakes the nuns made. Okay? So that's why there's a difference in the number of precepts. It's not a big deal. Yeah. Okay. The Buddha, in ordaining women, was really being quite going against social custom in a big way. I mean, you can see, you've all traveled within India. You see the situation of women now? Yeah? They aren't equal with the men. You go to the bazaar in the evening. Do you see men walking, women walking up and down the streets alone? No. A woman is either with a man or there's men walking up and down the streets. Okay? So even now, there is not gender inequality in India. Imagine India 2,600 years ago. Okay? A woman, and this is Indian culture, yeah, and it was European culture too, basically, for a long time. When she was young, she was under, you know, the protection or control of her father. When she got married, she was under the, you know, control of her husband or protection of her husband. And when she got older, she was under the control or protection of her child, her son. Okay? So in releasing women from the home life and letting them have their own spiritual life as a member of the Sangha, the Buddha was really going out on the limb. Okay, because women were so confined to the house 2,600 years ago. The only other order at the time of the Buddha that allowed women into it was the Jains. But all the other mendicant orders, including, you know, and the Brahmins, which were the religious hierarchy at the time, they were all men doing everything. So just in that social ambience, letting women ordain was a big thing. Okay? I think the story of how the nuns' order started, I find it very moving. And people interpret this story in a variety of different ways. But I'll just share with you my interpretation. You might know that the Buddha, after, you know, he was born, his mother died a week after he was born, so he was raised by his aunt, who was Mahaprajnapati, that was her name. And she raised the Buddha, you know, he left the family, he left his wife and his child, and went out to discover the truth, to free his mind, and to benefit sentient beings. He attained full enlightenment, and he went back, you know, at one point to see his family. And not to see his family, but to Kapilavastu, where his family, that was his family area. And his father had, probably wasn't his first visit back to Kapilavastu. I don't know which number visit it was, but it was about 6 years after his enlightenment. And he went back, his father had recently passed away. And his stepmother, his mother, you know, Mahaprajnapati, requested ordination, and he initially declined. And so he finished his teaching at Kapilavastu. He went to Vasali. Mahaprajnapati was a strong woman, you know, and she was really determined. She wasn't going to take no for an answer. She wasn't just going to say, well, okay, you know, and give up. And there were 500 women. Whenever they use the number 500 in scriptures, it didn't mean literally 500. It means a lot. Okay. But even, let's just take 500. Okay. So 500 Shakya women, imagine this. 500 Shakya women shave their heads. And you know, in India, long hair is a big deal, especially for women. They shave their heads. Yeah, they took off all their jewelry, all their finery, and you know that's a big deal. Okay, they took all that off, they put on robes, and 500 of them walked barefoot from Kapilavastu across India to Vasali. You know, this was not going to go unnoticed. Yeah, I mean, this is a big thing. Can you imagine that? 500 women with shaved heads, wearing saffron robes, walking across India barefoot, and they were royal women. I mean, these women were strong, and they were determined, and they were so sincere in their spiritual aspirations. Okay? They got to Vasali, and they saw Ananda, you know, and Ananda was one of the monks who was the Buddha's attendant. And they were, you know, saying to Ananda, you know, the Buddha refused us ordination in Kapilavastu. We really want to get ordained. So Ananda, you know, bless his heart, he, you know, really cherishes sentient beings. And he went to the Buddha and asked the Buddha, you know, can these women ordain? And the Buddha initially, again, said, you know, he didn't say no. He just said, don't ask. So actually, when, you know, at the beginning, when Mahaprajnapati had asked, he just said, don't ask. And so then Ananda said, well, can women attain, you know, enlightenment? Can they attain liberation just like men can? And the Buddha said, yes. And then Ananda said, well, why can't they ordain? They have that spiritual potential. Why not? The Buddha said, okay.
What is the Shakya?
The Shakya was the clan. Okay? There were all these different clans in India, so that was his clan. So the Buddha had given his permission for the ordination. And as the story goes, he gave Mahaprajnapati 8 special conditions for her ordination. And those 8, in effect, subordinated the order of nuns to the order of monks. Okay. Now, first of all, with Western historical analysis, some people wonder whether the Buddha actually said those or whether they were added later. We don't know. Okay. In any case, whether the Buddha said them, whether the monks added these stipulations later, given the nature of Indian society, you know, which was very patriarchal, it was a way of having the order of nuns being protected by the order of monks. And many of the vows that the monks have actually, because sometimes the monks might have started to take advantage of the nuns, you know, like wash my robes and, you know, can I have your alms and things like that. So the Buddha made vows that nuns are not allowed to wash monks' robes. Monks have to wash their own. Okay? That a monk cannot ask a nun for her alms, you know, her food. They have to, you know, collect it from either the junior monks or from the lay people. So there were certain vows also made to protect the nuns from social exploitation. But doing this, you know, I think was a way that accorded with Indian society at that time. Okay. Now, bringing this into modern times, I don't think this holds. Yeah, I mean, the status of women in society is much different now. Men and women, you know, relate on a much more equal level, going towards gender equality. We're not there yet. And so personally speaking, I think that now things need to change in terms of that. Because usually, as it is the nuns sit behind the monks, you know, because the order of nuns is seen as subordinate to the order of monks. Although the nuns within their own community are to function equally. And, you know, they're said to have equal privilege in taking ordination and equal responsibility in preserving the Dharma and practicing well. But I think as things go on in the West, it's much better to do it as Lama Yeshe did it, which is, he did it in another, there's a few different ways to do it, okay? But to do it in order of seniority, whether you're a monk or a nun. Because usually in our seating order, we sit in order of seniority. The person who was ordained first, you know, who's been ordained longest first, and then the next one, and next one. Okay? So instead of having the monks sitting in that way in their section, the nuns sitting in that way in their section, you could do it where everybody's sitting according to their age of ordination equally, you know, men or women. Or you could do what Lama Yeshe did. Instead of having one sit behind the other, have the Sangha sit with the nuns and the monks side by side, both sitting within their own communities in order of ordination. Okay. In any case, you're order of ordination just has to do with the time you ordained. It doesn't have to do with your level of spiritual realization. Okay? And where you sit, hopefully shouldn't disturb our mind too much, because we hopefully should be working on our own inner things instead of worrying about where we sit. However, having said that, I still think that seating arrangement, it's good to alter it so that it's more equitable between men and women. And I know at Shravasti Abbey, the monastery I'm setting up in the States, gender equality is, a basic founding principle of that. The only place I differ on gender equality is when it comes to carrying heavy things. Then the guys can do it. Okay. That issue I budge on. Okay. But I think especially when we're bringing Buddhism to the West, we have to be very careful and bring it in a gender equitable way. Also, in terms of language and translation, and I am still really sometimes astounded and horrified by how things still continue to be translated in a very gender-biased language. Okay? So I think we should use terms like, instead of Buddhist sons, Buddhist spiritual children. And I would even like to do away with the term monks and nuns altogether and just use a gender-neutral term like monastics. Okay? So everybody's referred to equally as a monastic. So in issues of translation, in all these kinds of things, as Buddhism is coming to the West, I think we need to be very, very attentive to it. And it's not just up to the women to point this out. It's up to the men to point it out too. Okay? Because whenever the women point it out, they say, oh, you're just complaining, you're a feminist. And that's not the issue at all. We aren't complaining. Yeah, but it's really an issue of how to present Buddhism to make it more accessible so that people can benefit from it. Okay? And in the West, gender equality is really the way to go. In the East, we cannot go and tell Tibetans and Indians and Thais and whoever to change their societies, That's none of our business. They do their societies the way they want to. We can, however, ask questions. We can give our financial support in certain areas and not in other areas. Okay? And in that way, benefit and support the causes that we, think are more worthy at that time. Okay? So, for example, supporting the nuns' communities. If you look at any of the monasteries, the monks definitely have more financial resources than the nuns do. They are also more numerous, okay, and more visible in society. But I think it's really good if we, and there's several nunneries here in this community, and especially the nunneries with the nuns who are studying and who are really trying to do sincere practice, if we give some of our support to those nunneries so that the nuns can really have, the support they need to do their practice. For example, the nunnery in South India in Mungote is totally full. There's 42 nuns that have to live outside and pay for their own room and support because there's no room inside the nunnery. And the nuns don't have enough money to buy extra land. In addition to those 42 nuns, there's a whole waiting list to get in. Okay? So there's definitely women who want to ordain and nuns who want to practice. And so, support those people and enable them to have the resources so they can hear the teachings and so on. Okay? So we can do that. If we go do protests and things like that, that just totally turns the Tibetans off. Okay? Doesn't do very much good at all. His Holiness has often said to us in groups and also personally, he said, when you meet discrimination, he didn't start out like that. He said, You go and get a good Dharma education. You go and make yourself into a good practitioner. If along that way you run into discrimination of some sort, then let us know. We'll see what we can do to help. Okay? But he was, and I found that actually very empowering. Okay? And I also learned throughout the years, do not wait for somebody else to change the situation so that you have a better opportunity to practice or to study the Dharma or to do whatever. You know, you go and do whatever you can within the existing arrangement, and as you develop qualities, then people naturally have to respect and listen to you. Okay? And so that's what I've seen happen in the Tibetan community and within the, you know, nuns in general and women in general in Buddhism, is we've gone ahead and, you know, gotten an education. You know, there's many more nunneries now than when I first came here. There is much better education for the women. There is still not equal education for the nuns. Okay? And there still is not equal opportunity for ordination for the nuns. And there needs to be a lot of work done in this area. But these issues are on the top of the list. The reason for the inequality and opportunity to ordain, this is for the full ordination for the nuns. For novice ordination, men and women can take it equally in the Tibetan, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism. But when you receive ordination, you have to receive it in a lineage of that can be traced from student to their teacher to their teacher to their teacher back to the Buddha in an unbroken lineage. Now, for the ordination of nuns, there were, you know, you needed a certain number of nuns to give the ordination ceremony. There was never that number of nuns coming over the Himalaya mountains from India to Tibet to give the ordination. It was a pretty arduous journey. Yeah. And for a group of women in that time to set out and do it themselves with all the brigands and whatever would have been quite dangerous. There were never, because to give the ordination you need a certain number of nuns, there were never that number of women from Tibet who went to India to take it to bring the lineage back. So the full ordination never spread to Tibet, and so they've never really had a community of bhikshunis, of fully ordained nuns. The community of bhikshunis did exist in ancient India. It went to Sri Lanka. King Ashoka sent his daughter there and also his son, and they established both the bhikshu and bhikshuni orders there. And then the ordination from women spread from Sri Lanka. It went by sea and also overland to China. And so the ordination lineage still exists within China and Taiwan, and from there it went to Korea and to Vietnam. So all those countries have the ordination lineage. So now there is discussion being done about how to, you know, introduce the ordination lineage into the Tibetan tradition. And this is one of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's priorities. Within the last year, he has spoken about it many, many times. And, you know, His Holiness is swimming upstream. He's our one big advocate because, you know, by and large, the rest of the monks are not so interested in this issue. It doesn't touch them very much because they're more concerned with their studies and their monasteries. But His Holiness is very much in favor of this. And we have establish a committee of Western bhikshunis who are doing research into how to do it. We have, and he has asked some Tibetan Vinaya scholars also to do some research. And in July of next year, there's going to be a conference in Hamburg, Germany, with Sangha members from various Buddhist traditions and scholars to discuss this. His Holiness has said that he alone as an individual cannot institute the order of nuns in the Tibetan community. Why? Because this is a decision that depends on the cooperation of all of the Sangha. So it's a group decision that has to be made, not an individual decision. He does not have the power to do that as an individual, but he certainly is supportive of it. What else to say? You know, in my own personal experience, I found that, you know, you just go ahead and do things. And our mind is not male, our mind is not female. The important thing is to get the Dharma teachings and put them into practice as best as we can, at whatever level we can, and slowly develop our practice. And it doesn't matter, you know, how old we are, what gender we are, what nationality or race or anything we are. You know, the whole thing is about putting the Dharma into practice in our own hearts. And then as we do so, then the situation on the outside will also improve. But like I say, when Buddhism is coming for the West, because that is our own society, then I think we really should, if we see instances of gender equality, then we should politely but consistently comment on them, you know? Because I think for the long-term benefit of sentient beings and the long-term existence of the Buddha Dharma in the West, this is quite important.